Welcome to the Context Machine, episode 666. I'm Brian Jack.
I've been waiting for
that. And I'm Jeff Gamet.
Hey, Brian.
Yeah.
If you take 666 and flip it over, it's 999.
Yeah.
Both numbers are divisible by 3, which is a prime number.
Oh, hell yeah, man. That's what you get with the Context Machine. You come here for the math nerd.
Oh man, did it get hot in here? Yeah. Or is it just me?
You know, what if we blew off recording this episode until Halloween?
It's funny you should say that, because I was thinking we should just skip the month until we get to the end and do a Halloween extravaganza.
Yeah, we haven't done that in a while. Anyway, you can find us at contextmachine.org.
No, hold on. Mm. I have a way to do this that's appropriate for the theme we're presenting.
Okay.
Please make sure to check us out at our haunted home online, contextmachine.io.
Let's pretend that I have added some, you know, spatial effects.
Yeah.
Which I could do, but I'm not.
Theater of the mind, friends.
Right. You can use contextmachine.io to reach out to us. You can find us on Mastodon at Context Machine. I'm on Threads at GeekTales. And where are you?
You can use your Ouija board or your local favorite medium to reach out to me anytime. And if you say my name 3 times into a mirror while holding a candle below your face, you'll light your face on fire. So don't do that.
Are you just assuming that we're not going to do another show before Halloween? But I mean, because that could be a fair assumption.
I mean, it could be a fair assumption, but we are in October, which means every day is Halloween.
Every day is Halloween. Do you know there's a song by that name?
There's also a wonderful movie that we should all just watch, Nightmare Before Christmas. Mm.
I would rather talk about Ministries every day this Halloween, but whatever.
It's we appeal to a broad audience, so it's okay to talk about both.
Okay, fair enough. But
and when I say broad audience, I mean I need to go on a diet.
Fair enough. But we do have a couple topics. One is, and I'm looking at my notes, Jeff's Linux. Beep. I fake beeped the wrong word. I'm gonna have to actually beep that for real. Dang it.
Oh, that was fantastic. That right there was worth coming home from the coffee shop and getting back in the studio on the other side of the glass from you to do the show just for that.
Fair enough. So I've got a note to fix that, and hopefully I did it.
If not, someone's going to let us know.
Yeah. So anyway, you started posting all these screenshots of you putting Linux on like a Mac from like 1972 or something. I don't know what was going on.
Right. Yeah. So I dug out my steam powered Mac. Finding coal that's compatible with the computer that old is a trick.
Right.
So no, actually, it's a 2013
Mac. Wow, 11 years old.
Yeah. And so it's the what would that be, like a 14-inch laptop?
I don't know. Tell me. They had multiple sizes back then.
Yeah, it's not the small one, it's the bigger one. So it's like 13 or 14-inch screen. And this computer, I used to use it a lot and as a Mac, of course. And like when you and I would go to conferences, and I didn't want to bring my bigger 16-inch laptop MacBook Pro, I would bring the MacBook Air.
You didn't have a 16-inch MacBook Pro because they only started making those in the last couple of years, and we haven't done the
conferences. Okay, so 15-inch MacBook Pro. Okay.
All right, thank you. You know, I feel like I should have preceded that with actually pushing up my
glasses. Yes, you should have, yeah. And I'm disappointed that you didn't. Anyhow, so this computer's just been sitting around occasionally getting pulled out to do, like, honestly, basically, I was using it with what's that DVD ripping software that I just forgot the name of? It has a pineapple for the icon. Everyone's yelling at their phone right now. No, the pineapple's right side up.
Pineapple Mac ripping software.
Everyone's yelling at their iPhone right now.
Handbrake.
Because they handbrake. And everyone's like, finally, yes. Holy crap. So yeah, so I was running Handbrake on it to rip DVDs because that's a whole nother show right there. Anyhow, so I really wasn't using it for anything. And so when did I post those pictures? Was it last week or the beginning of this week? I don't even remember. Maybe it was on the weekend, a few days ago.
Yeah. It was over the weekend.
And
into Monday too. But anyway, whatever.
Okay. So anyhow, just on a whim, I thought, you know, I've been hearing a couple other people, and one of them is a friend that I know through the British Tech Networking, and Grant, who had been saying Linux Mint, and which is that's just what they call that this distro of Linux, is pretty solid, and it's pretty easy to install, and it's a great way to breathe life into an older computer, and it supports Intel hardware. There's a version of it that'll even run on Apple's ARM hardware. And so I thought, you know, I'll give this a shot and let's just see what happens, because it would just be interesting to go through the process and see what's it like to install Linux on a machine today, because the last time I really did it was many years ago, and it was a slow process, lots of command line stuff happening to get it to work. And so I thought, yeah, let's give it a shot. And so I did it, and I was surprised at how approachable it was for someone like me. I think it would for you too. Someone that's just like your typical Mac or Windows user who goes to the store, buys a computer, everything's pre-set up on it, and they just want to use their stuff and that's it. This is probably not something they want to mess with. But for those of us that have a little bit more tech savvy, totally fine. And
I didn't actually get that impression from the pictures with the captions that went with them. I kind of got the impression that it was a bit of a hassle. So I'm surprised to hear you saying this.
No, it was not a hassle. But for the average person, it would have been intimidating enough that they would have been like, yeah, no, I'm not doing this. So what you saw at what you were perceiving as hassle was me calling out the things that that to me say, even with as relatively easy as this install was, this is not something for the average computer user. This is not something that anyone can hold up and legitimately say, look, you can use Linux as your main operating system. It's completely fine to hold this up against Mac OS or Windows. And the answer to that is no, it is not. And when you go and look at those photos that I posted on Instagram, which are also showing up on Mastodon, you'll see these photos that I took. By the way, I still haven't figured out how to do a regular screenshot on the computer. There are things that are very intimidating for the average user, but for someone that knows what they're doing, or is comfortable doing a couple Google searches about more technical stuff, they'd be able to get through it fine.
Why did you need to resurrect this machine anyway? What was the goal here? Like, was the goal here just to do it, or was the goal here to do it to accomplish some other purposes?
This was an educational project for me. I wanted to see what a modern Linux install is like, the whole experience.
Okay, so masochism. Okay, I got it.
Yeah, yeah. And it turns out I didn't need to use a safe word.
Well, that's good.
All right. Okay, so there was another element that did play into this some. And it's because I was really pissed off over the weekend, apparently, with iOS 18 and macOS tall trees, because I'm having
the
issues that people
are talking about Sequoia, and he's talking about macOS 15. So go ahead.
And iOS 18. So I've been having some issues with email and certificates and audio, just these things that for some people wouldn't even matter, but for people like us, where we're using our computers heavily to record shows and have business communications. I was hitting these problems where it's like, I am just so pissed off right now. I just want to see what else is an option, even though it's not like it would be a legit option or even reasonable to switch platforms. So that was part of it. But I mean, the big part of it was, I just wanted to see what I could do with a 13-year-old MacBook Air that has 4 gigs of RAM and a 256 gig SSD. And would this even install?
And I'm guessing that poking your eye out with a sharp stick or donating it wasn't an option.
No. I just didn't feel either would be sanitary.
All right, fair enough. I'm glad that all right. I was glad that I was following along at home occasionally by looking at your pictures as opposed to the doing.
That's fair. Yeah.
I've definitely lost my I've lost my tolerance for doing something like that unless I need to.
And that's fair. And I didn't need to, but it was still pretty cool.
It is cool that you did it. And I'm not saying that I've lost my tolerance and taste for that. I'm not bragging. I'm confessing.
No, I get it. All right. So I'm going to walk you quickly through what my whole process was, I had to experience. So I started at the Linux Mint website, which is linuxmint.com. And yes, there'll be a link to that in the show notes, for those of you that are interested. And, they actually have really good step-by-step walkthroughs on getting an installation to happen. So the first thing you have to do.
Hold on. Do they have a version of this that runs on 68K processors? I'm looking at you, Neil. Neil, the noted architect Pan, because he has all of the Macs at this point.
I bet there's a version that'll run on a 68K, but I don't think Linux Mint has one. All right. So first thing you have to do is download this disk image, which is, it's an ISO file. So basically it's a software or it's a file that you would use to like burn an image onto a DVD, but you can also use it to make an image onto like USB thumb drive.
Okay. Or a CD.
No, it would have to be a DVD.
Interesting. Okay. Did you use a DVD or did you use a thumb drive?
That would, I used a thumb drive.
Yeah, that's what to say. That would be way
easier. Yeah.
So you needed to, you could download this on not the Mac that you're targeting.
Right. So I started on my M2 MacBook Pro and downloaded the image and so to like, if I was going to make a DVD, the operating system can just do that for me. Not a problem. But I wanted to do the USB stick. They have instructions on how to do that. And it was like, you need to go download this, this application called Etcher. And it's a tool that's designed just so that, you can take these ISO files and write them off to a thumb drive, because it needs to be something that can be readable and bootable. And so I'm like, all right, I'll go get this tool, downloaded it, and let it do its thing. And then I had this little USB stick, went over to the MacBook Air, popped it in, restarted the computer, and did the thing where you hold down the option key so you can choose what your startup drive is going to be. And the built-in drive and the USB stick both showed up, which surprised me, because I'm like, it didn't tell me I'm downloading something that's specifically an installer for a Mac. It's just, this is the disk image, so I guess it has the stuff on it so it can boot a Mac or a Windows machine, simply because I'm booting an Intel processor, I guess. But anyhow, so I picked that, and it then gave me the option, do you want to try and change your partitions so you can dual boot, or do you want to just make this just a Linux machine? And at this point, I thought, well, let's go all in. So I let it reformat the whole SSD and install Linux, which meant that if it didn't work, I was going to have to fall back to the firmware on the laptop and connect it to my network, and then have it download a Mac install image and start over. But anyhow, so I thought, yeah, let's commit to this, and it did the whole installation and rebooted. And I was like, wow, that wasn't too bad. And then it brings up the thing where I'm like, all right, this is where it's going to get a little intimidating for the average person, because it brings up this thing where it's now detecting devices that are part of your computer and asking you what driver you want.
Mm.
And
I could see how that could quickly become intimidating.
Yeah, that could become intimidating real fast. But it wasn't as bad as it would have been had I not been able to, during the initial installation, get my laptop onto my Wi-Fi network, because then the installer was able to go out to the server and download stuff from the Linux Mint server. So some of the things it would have otherwise asked me about, it didn't need to, because it was able to get the stuff and install it for me automatically. But there were a couple drivers where I had to choose what I wanted. And luckily I know what Broadcom chips were in the computer. So I was like, yep, boop, we'll do that. And then it goes through this process where it's clear they're trying to make it Mac-like, where it was as friendly as possible for walking you through a lot of the setup stuff. But it was still there were some intimidating points along the way. Like when I got to let's add a printer, it comes up with this whole dialogue window thing where unless you know what you're actually looking at, you would have no idea what to choose to even pick your printer, even though it's like right there. And then what does it need for drivers? It that would have been a showstopper for some people, sure. Which is one of the pictures that I posted. But I was pretty sure what I needed to select, and I was correct. And so I can print from this thing. It asked me, do you want to turn on the firewall? Sure, I did. Then it has a snapshot backup thing. So it's basically Time Machine for Linux. Do you want to turn that on? Sure, turn that on. Then when it's done and it did another reboot and I'm at the desktop, I'm like, great. What's on this computer? And it had some software installed.
Oh, wait.
It had Firefox.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about what got installed by this Linux installation. You're not talking about the original data you had.
This is all just what happened from the Linux install.
Okay, got it.
Because at this point, everything that was on the computer when it was booting Mac OS was gone.
Right, okay, of course.
Yeah. So it had Firefox on it, which my first thought was, because of course it has Firefox on it, because that's what Linux people like to use. Which was fine for getting started, and at some point I'll figure out what other browser options there are. But then I thought, well, let's turn this into a machine where if I want to take it to the coffee shop, I can work. And so first step was, you need to get 1Password on this. So I have all my passwords. 1Password has a Linux version. So it didn't there's like Linux Mint's version of the App Store, but it's an app repository thing. And it wasn't there. But when I went to the 1Password site, there was a place there where I could do the install. So I'm like, okay, great. And I had 1Password installed. Dropbox has a Linux version, installed that. I also realized, I want to check email. And here's a place where the Linux install fell down a little bit. It wasn't obvious to me that there was an email app on there. And so I was like, I have to go find an email app. So I did some Google searching and I figured out what the options were, picked one that was not Thunderbird because I really, really, really do not like Thunderbird. Got it installed and then found out, oh, no, Thunderbird was already there. But anyhow, so then I had an email app installed. And then I thought, well, I need something so I can write, something that just makes text files. And, of course, longtime Linux users are like, that's already built in at your command line. You can do all this stuff. And no, my objective was no command lines, Brian. I want to do Linux without ever having to launch a terminal and go into a command line and see if I can make it happen. So I went searching and I found a tool for that or an app for that, installed it. And you can tell a lot of these apps, they're written by people who have a love for the platform. But they're not like installing 1Password. I ended up with an app that when you look at it, it looks like a big company designed this app and it has the very sleek professional look. What I installed, and I just forgot the name of the app that I installed to do text editing. It launches and I'm like, wow, if you weren't comfortable just with interfaces that aren't completely friendly, you'd look at this and have no idea what this program is even for, let alone how to get started. So, you know, for me, not a big deal because it's an experiment, but I wouldn't want to hand this computer off to my dad, who, and my dad's really smart, but he'd be looking at it and he wouldn't, there'd be no indication that he was looking at a text editing tool.
Right. Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And anyhow, so I found all the apps I needed to have this as a machine that I could take to a coffee shop and do some work and like do legit work, and got it all set up. And then I sat there and looked at it and I thought, wow, now I have a new appreciation for how tightly integrated all of Apple's devices are. Like being able to bring up a two-factor authentication code in Authy on my iPhone, copy it, and it's immediately available on the clipboard on my Mac. I had to manually type in two-factor authentication codes.
Right.
You know, there's no handoff. So stuff that I just do every day where I'm throwing data back and forth without thinking about it, that's not happening. And it was just little things like that that I take for granted. I suddenly didn't take for granted.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But I now have this little laptop that if I so choose, I can take it to the coffee shop. It even has controls so I can turn the backlight on for the keyboard and control how bright it is. And it just works. Had I not installed the new driver for the built-in Wi-Fi, which is one of the Broadcom chips, it still would have worked on Wi-Fi, but I have better support for the built-in Wi-Fi chips because I let it install the different drivers. And it'll even do automatic software updates. If I wanted, I could install like themes on it and make it look like it's Mac OS X.
Okay.
But anyhow, it's turns out that it took me a couple hours after the install, which didn't take that long. I think most of my time was spent doing Google searches to find apps to install on the thing to do the other things that I wanted and get all that stuff up and running.
So are you going to use it?
I'll use it some. I won't use it all the time. Like today I decided to go right at my favorite little local coffee shop, and I considered taking what I'm calling my Mint Book Air, and then decided not to because I was on a tight enough deadline that I didn't want to get into what I was working on.
Plus,
and then realize there's something that I'm missing.
Plus, it's not sanitary.
Well, neither am I, so you know. I could totally see me just to see how well it works, take this over to the coffee shop and work for a little bit if I'm just working on some writing, and if it doesn't work out, okay, well, where I live isn't that far from the coffee shop. I'll just go back home. So yes, I'm going to experiment with this outside of my kitchen counter.
Which yeah, is I can't imagine anything right more horrid than that. But hey, that's just me. I really don't have. I don't have it in me to do this stuff anymore. The playing with inferior technology to play with inferior technology.
It's still not the experience that that a Mac user or a Windows user would want to have. But it's amazing the progress that has been made
sure.
with some of these Linux distributions.
That makes sense.
So, I still have the energy to burn time experimenting with stuff like this. Here's the thing. Let's say that you're okay messing around with stuff like this and you have an old Mac sitting around that you need to repurpose, or would be nice to repurpose. So maybe your kids have something that they can just like log into school stuff and write, or you want a computer that's handy next to the television because you don't have an iPad, and you're using a desktop Mac, but you got that old MacBook Air sitting around. This is something you can do where you have a modern operating system on it. So you can do the modern operating system things, even though it's not Mac OS. So it's an interesting way to take old hardware, like my 2013 MacBook Air, and make it something that's usable with modern software.
Yeah, fair enough. Good. Yay. Glad.
Yeah.
Someone's got to do it, so I'm glad it's you.
Yeah. Next experiment, because it turns out that there's a really popular cross-platform tablet trying app, which I don't remember the name of, but it's one of those things that someone was telling me, hey, you need to check this out. So I need to plug my Wacom tablet into this ancient MacBook Air, my MintBook Air, and see if I can make that work with this drawing app. No, we are not going down the GIMP path. No. I have messed with GIMP on Mac OS before. No.
And GIMP is essentially an open source Photoshop competitor.
Yes. Let's call it an alternative, because I wouldn't even call it a competitor.
Various generous. Yeah, the competitor was using a lot of work in my description, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyhow, this will be an ongoing experiment. And if anyone's thinking, holy crap, Jeff's about to walk away from Mac OS and become a Linux user full time. No.
No, I didn't think that at all.
No, there's way too much that I do that relies on software that I'm running on my Mac, and the integration with my other Apple devices is actually really important to my workflows. So no, this is a fun experiment, something I can use for some projects every now and then.
I predict you won't really use it, but hey, that just could be my inner cynic. I mean, that could be massively projecting.
I've never known you to do that. Why would you start now?
Well, you know, got to turn over a new leaf.
That's true. This is how you keep the excitement and mystery in our relationship.
Yes. Yes.
All right. So you know how much all of this cost me?
Oh, yeah.
Money-wise?
Yeah. No, I don't.
Zero.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I had a thumb drive sitting around. Already had the computer. You can make donations to all these software developers and the Linux distro developer.
And it seems like you should. At least make some donations to at least some of them.
Yeah, if this is stuff you're going to like actually use, make those donations.
Yeah.
And sure. Seriously, do it. Yeah. Because that's how you get support and updates and stuff. But yeah, everything that I needed, I already had. And so it was just download, make that thumb drive, get the machine up and running, and away we go.
Cool. Awesome, even.
Yeah.
All right. So you had questions about D&D, I think. Is this correct?
Yes, I do. And
I'm assuming that's not going to be a spoiler for anyone who looked at the title of the show. But for everyone else, it's a spoiler.
Yeah. Everyone, Brian has no idea what I'm asking him. I just said, hey, I have some D&D questions
for you. And I said, surprise me.
Okay, so here we are.
Giddy up.
Okay, so Brian.
Yeah.
I've been seeing talk online about changes that are coming to D&D, more like digital stuff, and I'm curious, what does that really mean for someone like me who's now getting into D&D, and I bought my printed book so that I have a reference thing. Did I waste money buying a book because stuff is changing? What's going on with this change stuff with D&D?
That's a fun topic to me. I want to be clear. This is a fun topic to me and to someone like me, because I mean, on the one hand, of course it's not wasted money, because you know, you have let me back up. So the deal is, mm-hmm. is that Wizards of the Coast, which is owned by Hasbro, is updating the core rules for D&D. They're calling it D&D 5th Edition 2024. This contrasts with D&D 5th Edition, which came out in 2014. So this is a 10-year update. And this Wizards of the Coast, and before that TSR, did oftentimes release new rules, and this was one, to make improvements to the games, and two, to give people reasons to buy more editions of the books. So, you know, that's definitely at play here. But it's been 10 years, and it does seem like they've put a lot of thought into the changes that they're making. So the reality, though, is for any changes to D&D, if you have your books and you play live on a tabletop, you don't have to pay any attention to the new rules at all. Like, you know, there's nothing that can stop you from opening up your old books, or, you know, not even opening up your old books because you know them so well, and just continuing to play the old rules. If you're someone who needs to be playing the latest and greatest, which I don't think I've ever met that particular mindset in this particular application, like the latest and greatest, I don't really think that's a thing for D&D.
Okay.
But anyway, regardless, I mean, like, it seems to me that the kind of people who are going to want to play the 5th edition 2024 rules are the people who want to do something new and are maybe interested in particular changes.
Okay, so when you say particular changes, what does that mean? And you don't need to go into like super deep detail, like for this one character, it changes their eye color. But like, what does it mean when there are changes?
So they are changing. All right. So first of all, they're releasing the Player's Handbook was released in September. The Dungeon Master's Guide is going to be released in November, and I think the Monster Manual is either December or January. So
you have the Player's Guide,
Player's Handbook,
which. Please. Okay, so the Player's Handbook, which has information that is no longer in line with what's in the DM's guide, because that isn't out yet.
Correct. They've almost always released them in staggered progression, for what that's worth. Historically, they have.
So how would that work, though?
Well,
use the masters doing one thing that, or anyhow, fill me in.
So the 2024 rules were designed to be retroactively compatible with the 2014 rules. So yes, there are changes.
Oh, okay.
There are changes, but it's not. This is not like. All right. So let me back up again. When they released third edition and then updated to 3.5, those were, it was not designed to be interactively dependent and interactively compatible. And I would say that every time they've released a 0.5 update to the rules, those updates were not compatible with the previous rules. But this one, I'm guessing that they very specifically wanted to make sure that that people could, you know, keep doing their thing or as much of their thing as they wanted to. I don't really specifically know the stated philosophy of these updates, but regardless, they are. What was the question? I'm losing my train of thought.
You did it. You got through. Well done. So all right. So next question. I'm seeing all this stuff about digital. And I don't think I'm understanding it right, because the takeaway that I'm getting is that what Wizards of the Coast, that's who owns D&D, right?
Yes.
Wizards of the Coast. Okay. What they want is to get us all to use their stuff online and make them pay, or make us pay extra stuff for doing that. Am I interpreting that correctly?
Not really. So yeah, there are lots of people who play D&D online. This is especially true since the pandemic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there are virtual tabletops. These are online systems that are designed to allow all of you to be looking at some version of the same map or the same, you know, battle maps or something like that, so that you can move your little tokens around that represent your characters, and the DM can move the little tokens to represent the monsters, everyone's sort of looking at the same thing.
Okay, so that's what Roll 20 is for us. For those of you that don't know, Brian totally roped me into D&D and the group that we are all playing with. We're scattered across the United States, and so we're using Roll 20. And so that's what you're talking about, that sort of thing?
Yes. And
now, is Roll 20 a separate company, or is that part of D&D?
Oh, they're totally a separate company. And they license the ability to include D&D rules in their virtual tabletop. So they also license several other games too.
Okay, that makes sense, because I've seen some stuff in there where I saw other games. And I was assuming that was just like all part of the Wizards of the Coast D&D properties. But no, it's a bunch of different tabletop games. And got it. Okay, I'm with you.
And Wizards of the Coast would like you to be using their virtual tabletop system.
Of course, because then that's more money for them.
Yes.
That's how business works.
Yes. And there was one video I watched that made the argument that Wizards is trying to essentially corner the market on selling or reselling the books, the physical books, so that you can only buy them from Wizards. They haven't done that yet, but basically they screwed a lot of their hobby shops and other people that are on the distribution side of things. And so
but that's, you know, crappy.
Yeah, it's crappy. It is legit crappy. But regardless, Wizards wants you to use their virtual tabletop system, and that's built into a product called D&D Beyond. And what's my point? My point is that they're playing catch up in some ways. Roll 20 is definitely further ahead in a lot of aspects of this, And I'm actually wondering if Wizards is going to pull their license for incorporating the rules at some point. That seems like a modern Wizards of the Coast Hasbro action. I don't know that they're going to do that. I don't have any information that they're going to do that. But I'm really kind of waiting for that hammer to fall.
I hope that doesn't happen, because it seems like what we're using right now is just fine, and I like the idea of people having options for how they're doing this. So hopefully they let these other companies continue to license so they can do their own virtual tabletops.
Yeah, hopefully. So in any event, the other I'm gonna take out this bit where I look completely confused. The thing that you're asking about is the microtransactions and the other things that are tied to their virtual tabletop. So they want you to move to their tabletop, and I feel like they're trying to make their tabletop the best virtual tabletop that's out there. Mm-hmm. I'm personally not particularly interested in the virtual tabletop, but whatever. And their efforts to the reason why they want to get you moved over to the D&D Beyond virtual tabletop is so that they can charge you for things. So like they want to be able to charge you like a microtransaction for having a particular set of dice that you roll, or a particular look to your character sheet, or a particular avatar frame. I mean, like these are petty things that the video game industry has, you know, Fortnite, for instance, you know, they make their money from selling you skins, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they're wanting to tap into. And I feel like this decision is being driven by a bunch of bros. They're not D&D people. They're like, hey, we've got this, you know, we can really maximize our monetization out of this game by getting everyone playing online and by moving to all these microtransactions. So they've moved a bunch of video game people from, like, say, Blizzard and some other video game people into key positions. And the reality, though, is that this doesn't have to affect you, right? If you've got the books, you can just open the books and play with the books. You don't have to even worry about what's on D&D Beyond or the D&D Beyond virtual tabletop. You don't have to worry about it. You don't have to be involved with it if you don't want. If you are playing online, there could come a day where you have to, I could see like the next version of these books not being books. I could see that, unfortunately. I don't think they'll do that, but I could see them doing it.
You know, I get what you're saying. And of course their profit margins would be much higher if it's just a digital distribution.
Well, and if they're making you have to play online.
Right. Yeah. But man, having that player's guide, the print version, I am so glad I have that. I mean,
player's handbook, player's handbook, that there is something sacrosanct in the name, the player's handbook. So would you please use it?
I will do my best to comply with your pedantic.
Hey, this is tradition. This is legacy.
You know, you've got me playing D&D. You should be happy for that, and I'm enjoying it.
I am. I'm very happy.
All right. So the book that I will now refer to is Voldemort, because apparently I cannot say its name. I'm so glad I have that. I got it. I started flipping through it. It was much easier for me to start learning about characters and other aspects of the game, being able to have that printed book. And then I was able to start putting tabs in to mark pages where it's stuff that I know I want to reference regularly. And it's much easier for me than trying to do this with a digital book.
Yeah, so. It's interesting. So I definitely like flipping through the books more than I like flipping through the books in a digital format. But mm-hmm. I also like searching. So like when I need to do something and I can open up a new browser tab and type in, my search term D&D. 5e and just have the right page come up. I definitely like that.
I can see the value in that, especially if you are the DM for a game where being able to get it information quickly.
Right.
Is useful for keeping the game moving along.
But to pull this up, you know, you do have to I've got the physical books here, but then I've also had to buy the digital books on Roll20, and that was after, unfortunately, I had bought them on D&D Beyond.
So you have two versions of the digital books.
And?
Wait, so this isn't like a PDF. This is like you've bought something where you have to be logged into the service.
Yes.
That actually really concerns me, because you've bought this, and what if they go away, and now you've lost those books?
Right. And that's something that Wizards could do. And this is in addition to paying like the $100 a year that it costs to get the extra bitchin' version of Roll20's virtual tabletop.
And is that what we have when we're playing, the extra bitchin' version?
Yeah, the lighting features and things like that.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, right. These things do cost money. But Roll20, I don't feel like they're trying to microtransaction us to death, and I feel like Wizards wants to microtransaction us to death. I know that sucks. our audience probably skews a little bit older. You know, I think there's probably a lot of Gen Xers listening to us. And maybe, possibly, you haven't played games and don't realize that microtransactions are all the rage in the gaming industry for maximizing their monetization possibilities with the user. But that's the state of the game industry these days.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan. I mean, I get how it fits in with the business model, and clearly it works, because so many game companies are doing this. I mean, from stuff that you're playing online to stuff that you're buying for your iPhone or your Xbox, your Switch or whatever. It's just part of the reality of so many of these games.
Of course.
Okay, so what I'm getting out of this is that for right now, I don't need to be worried.
Nope.
And I haven't wasted my money by buying the version of the Voldemort book that I have.
Yep.
And the way we're playing, we'll be able to continue doing that for the foreseeable future. But at some point down the road, Wizards of the Coast could start pulling shenanigans on us and start forcing everyone by pulling licenses just to use their own version.
Yeah,
the virtual tabletop.
I can very much see that happening. Again, I don't know. I have no inside information. I haven't even read anyone talking about that. That's just my own suspicion.
But you follow this stuff closely, so that's why I'm okay asking you and then forming these opinions based on what you're telling me.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
All right.
So, anyway, but I'm enjoying playing again.
I'm having a lot of fun, and I'm glad you pulled me into this.
Oh, good.
I don't have dice, but right now it doesn't matter because we're playing virtually. So right. I've got the book, so I have a reference thing in front of me, but
how,
I don't
how
have
you
a
not bought dice yet.
I haven't needed them for anything.
That's not what I asked.
I guess what I need to do is go visit one of the local gaming stores that's here around Boulder or Longmont and go pick out a set of dice just so I have it.
Yeah, you should. I think you should. Yeah. Heck yeah. Go get yourself a set of dice, man. I mean, I'm not saying that you should go get yourself 40 or 50 sets of dice. I'm not also saying that I have 40 or 50 sets of dice. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that I've got at least a dozen, maybe more sets of gemstone D&D dice that are glorious. That are glorious.
All right. So I have to ask, since I don't have any dice, when you're buying all these different sets of dice, is it because you like having the dice, or are there specific use cases where one of these dice sets is more appropriate than another set?
Oh yeah. It's no, I can't even finish that with a straight face. So forever, the very first D&D dice, the dice that were included in the D&D boxed set, the basic set. This was pre-advanced Dungeons and Dragons. This was like levels 1 through 5, the end. And
what years are we talking?
This is like 77 or 6 or something like that. It's a long time ago.
Okay.
And so the box set came with a set of dice, and those were like made out of plastic, and they chipped and they lost their edges, which means that you could spin them really easily because they would get rounded. But that also meant that they became, first of all, uneven, and second of all, like they could sometimes like roll across the table anyway, but that's beside the point. That was the only set that I know of that was made out of plastic. Most dice have been made out of some kind of resin forever. Okay. And the thing that would get me to buy a set of dice is that they look cool. And so, you know, the game shops would have, you know, vast amounts of dice set up and, you know, vast amounts of dice and set up in tubes. And, you know, and in different kinds of collections, and they just feel good in your hand, and, you know, and like, yeah, dice, woo. It's definitely like, you know, triggering my, collector.
Okay. Okay.
And I realized that you don't totally really have, you're not afflicted with the collector.
No.
And that's good.
Not.
But
yeah, I mean, I do have a handful of fountain pens.
It seems like you should have,
not like a collector.
It seems like you should have a set of dice. Maybe, all you know, right, what? Well, why don't I send you a set of dice? We'll talk about. We'll talk about. We'll talk, right, about.
We'll
it
talk about.
It. I should maybe send you a set of dice.
Well, I'm happy to go visit my local game store. But I'm also happy to just talk this stuff with you anyhow, because it's fun.
Yeah, it is fun. It is fun. But let's hope that it was fun for our listeners, because we are at an hour.
Well, and but just by chance, seriously, folks, just by chance, I don't have any more D&D questions for Brian today. So that the timing worked out great.
All right. So let me do this. You heard that this time, didn't you?
I did. Holy forking shirtballs, I did.
That's great. Anyway, that's this week's Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on that or question, or if you're just wanting to know what the heck we mean when we say that Jeff can hear this now, you can write us at contextmachinepodcast@gmail.com. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Dr. Boom, recorded just for the show. And that's all for this week. Sorry for the pregnant pause.
That's okay. I was going to come up with something clever to say while you got the video or audio queued up, but no, didn't need to. And don't worry, no one noticed.